From the Conference Center in Salt Lake City, this is Conversations, featuring discussions with members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with a unique perspective or an interesting story. Today's conversation is with Gary Saran, who has experienced much adversity in his life, yet has learned much about faith, forgiveness, and love. Join us as we learn some great lessons in this exclusive interview on the Mormon Channel. The host for this conversation is Ruth Todd. Ruth is a former television news anchor and is currently a radio and television personality.
Welcome to Conversations on the Mormon Channel. This is a show where we hear the unique, inspiring, or moving stories of members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Ruth Todd, and I'm your host today, and we are delighted and honored to have our guest. Our guest today has a story that is all of those. It is unique, it is inspiring, and it's moving. Gary Saran, welcome to Conversations. So glad you're here.
Thank you, Ruth. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, as a longtime news person, I remember this story. I remember this story on the news. It was a Christmas Eve story. It's your life, but it was the lead of the news for several days and what was happening in the aftermath. And as a news person, I could probably just say, a mother and two children died in a tragic car accident on Christmas Eve. But that doesn't even begin to tell your story. You tell me. Let's take the news person out of it. You tell me what happened on Christmas Eve 2006.
Well, Christmas Eve, we had just finished performing in our last performance of A Christmas Carol.
We meaning?
My son Caleb and my daughter Clarissa and I had just finished performing our last show of A Christmas Carol. And I played Bob Cratchit. They played my children.
Mm-hmm. And this is a community theater program.
It is. Mm-hmm. And so there are some very moving scenes in there that I really related to. And every night was just an absolutely beautiful experience being able to share a really valuable Christmas message about hope and about healing.
Mm-hmm.
And became very pertinent in my life very quickly. I also, right afterwards, we ended up going to a cast party for all of the people from both casts and just had a wonderful evening sharing time with friends and gave a lot of hugs, and out the door we went. And we figured on the way home we would stop off and get a few last-minute Christmas things taken care of. And it was rather late at the time. It was about, I guess, 11:30 when we left Hale Center Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove over. On our way home, we stopped at a local department store, a local Walmart, and I went in originally thinking I would just stay for 15 minutes and grab a couple of things really quickly. As it turned out, I was in there for 2.5-3 hours.
Christmas Eve shopping, those last-minute things,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it gets a little crazy.
Yeah.
And so my wife, actually at the time, our car had a problem with the radiator. And so for the car to stay warm, you had to keep driving it. And so my wife was driving in circles for 2.5 or 3 hours around the parking lot at Walmart. Anyway, when we got there, one of my sons wanted to go in for a minute. And so my son, Ian, who was just about to turn 16, and we had raced many, many times, and I was always beating him. And so this particular evening, he wanted to race me into the store. And I remember racing into the store. And as we ran through the parking lot, all of a sudden he pulled ahead of me. And I don't know if you've ever seen in one of the Rocky movies, there's a scene where Rocky's racing Apollo Creed, and Apollo's trying to teach him to run faster. And he finally beats him for the first time, and then they just hug, and they're spinning around in circles, embracing each other. And that was Ian and I that evening.
He beat you, and it was good for both of
you. For the very first time, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, when we got there, incidentally, I remember going back afterwards thinking how much I would love to have seen the security video.
Sure.
But I went back too late.
So tell
us
what happened.
Eventually, after we left, we started heading home. My wife couldn't find the exit because she'd never been there. They'd just remodeled, and she couldn't find the exit to get out of the parking lot. Ended up taking a totally different way home than we would normally take. And as we headed down 5400 south towards the freeway, we got to about 700 west. And as we were going through a green light, all of a sudden we saw this truck coming into the intersection, a large red GMC truck. And it was such a startling thing because, you know, here you think of visions of sugar plums dancing in people's heads and how we were so excited about Christmas and all that it would bring and had finally gotten to rest after all these several months of performing and so forth. And we're so excited to have the next day tomorrow to be all together as a family. And I glanced to my right and saw this truck coming probably 50 miles an hour or so through the red light. I had a split second just to think, what on earth is going through his mind? And next thing you know, we were hit broadside. And it hit basically half on each of the two doors on the right side of our car.
All right, go over again exactly who was in the car. You were driving.
Actually, normally I would have been driving.
But you'd been shopping.
I'd been shopping. And when I came back out to the car, incidentally, right before I left, it was so extraordinary because my wife called me and she asked me how long I would be. I told her I was in line to go out. And the last words she ever spoke were, "I love you, sweetie." And I just remember thinking how many people would drive around for 2.5 hours in a parking lot and then say, "I love you." Anyway, so I got to the car, and Cheryl had been in the driver's seat. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Juliana had moved up to the front. She was 7 years old, 7.5. She moved up right next to Cheryl so that she could
snuggle together. They were in the front, and
he was in
the
together.
Back. Mm-hmm.
And then Ian took my place where I had been in the passenger seat, and he was there in the passenger seat, reclined. In the back, I was behind Cheryl, behind the driver's side. Caleb was next to me.
So there were five of you in the car.
Six of us, actually.
Six of you in the car.
And then my daughter, Clarissa, was behind Ian.
Right. And then what next? Do you remember it?
I remember everything. I was totally conscious and awake and alert through it. And I remember when we first got hit, it felt as if my body completely shut down. I sensed that my heart wasn't beating. I couldn't breathe. I imagine it's kind of like when you get winded in football or something, where you get hit so hard you can't breathe. And it seemed to last forever. And then, suddenly it was almost as if I rebooted or something, and I could feel myself start again, and I felt the pain. And I started looking around me to see what was happening and what was going on. And basically, as we got hit, we went across the median to the other side of the road, then swerved back to the right, went back over the median, across 2-3 lanes, and then up a curb. And we sat there in stillness. I made sure that the car had stopped, and the engine was off at that time. And as I looked around, Ian's head was in my lap. Halfway between Caleb and I, Caleb's eyes were open. He was awake, but he has no recollection of anything. So I noticed Ian and that he wasn't alert. And so I immediately started to give him a blessing. And as I began, I could sense that he had just passed away. Cheryl had, right before we were hit, she just exclaimed, "Oh no," and she threw herself on Julie to make sure that she would be safe. And so she was in that same position. She was laying
over
face
your daughter.
Down. And I didn't actually realize that Julie was there at the time of when I started looking around. And I became very concerned, in fact, because I couldn't find her. I couldn't see her anywhere. She was lying across the front seat towards the center. Clarissa was on the side that was hit. She had been a dancer, was hoping to be on the folk dance team at BYU. And all of a sudden, her legs were just in twisted metal, and she was screaming hysterically. Caleb was beside me, and at one point he asked Clarissa to stop screaming because he was getting frightened, but he really was, he didn't know what was going on. She was clearly in shock. Her eyes were open, but really glassy.
How long did it take before emergency help came?
It seemed to be very quick. I would think within 3 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately I decided to get those who I could out of the car. So I tried to get Caleb out, and I got him out and sat him on a curb. There were some people were there, and so I asked a woman who had seen the accident if she would sit down and put her arm around him, because I said this is going to be a very difficult thing. Then I tried to go around to Clarissa's door and get her out, and there was just no way because of how mangled it all was that I could open the door. By the time paramedics arrived, I remember two of them coming up to the car, and one looked in the window from the right side, and he took a quick look at Ian and then just looked up at the other and shook his head side to side to indicate that he was gone. I remember that moment when I realized that she was gone. One of the very first things I did was right after the accident. I remember I just called out to her. I just said, "Cheryl? Cheryl? Cheryl?" And somehow I just knew.
You knew.
Mm-hmm. And by that point, I had found my daughter underneath my wife. Mm-hmm. I reached down and felt that she had a strong pulse. So I told them that she was there and asked if they would try to save Julie. I understand that they worked for about 4 hours to try and save her, and were unable to. So about 6 in the morning, when I was lying in a hospital emergency room, they came and told me that she was gone as well.
So on that Christmas day, that Christmas morning, your life, your family was truly shattered. Tell me, what are the things you remember about that Christmas morning or the days right after, as you really started to take in what had happened to your family, how your life was unalterably changed? What are the remembrances of that period of time?
Well, that was Christmas Eve morning. I spent most of that day in the hospital. Of course, my daughter Clarissa was in University Medical Center. My son Caleb was in Primary Children's. Neither of them, even though both were awake, neither of them had any recollection of the accident, and they had no idea what had happened. And doctors and nurses refused to tell them anything. They would simply say, "Everything will be all right," or "Someone else is taking care of your father," things like that. And Christmas Day, one of the things I remember most was I had been released. I got to go see the others. And one of the most difficult things I think I've ever had to do was to go and tell them what had happened. And with Caleb in particular, I remember I went in and sat down with him. The doctor was there. We had a couple of close friends, and my bishop was with me. And I just sat down with him, and I said, "Caleb, do you have any idea what's happened?" And he didn't have any idea. I said, we've been in a really, really bad accident. And Mom didn't make it. And neither did Ian. And neither did Julie. And he had a single tear run down his cheek. And after a brief moment, he just looked at me and he smiled. And he said, it's all right, Dad. We're still a family. And that has been the attitude that he's had ever since. He's been an absolute rock ever since.
Tell me about the funeral. I'm sure that you were just still in somewhat of a state of shock as things happened, but that funeral was really poignant.
Funeral was an absolutely amazing experience. President Monson came and visited with us at the viewing that we had. There were, I would imagine, thousands of people who actually came and attended the viewing the 2 days. The family prayer was an extraordinary experience. Being in the room for the family prayer, Elder Recker was there and President Monson. And my son Ian was buried with a sword, the sword of the king from Lord of the Rings, which he really loved. And the inscription on it was something that always meant a lot to him. And in essence, it said that something to the effect, you know, may the minions of the kingdom of evil flee from me. And that was the way he was. He was a warrior. And at one point, President Monson turned to Elder Recker and he said, you served in the military, didn't you, Elder Recker? And he said, would you join me in a salute? And the two of them saluted my son. And I remember going over to my wife's casket. I felt to take my shoes off. She was kind of a pioneer woman in many ways. Just as good and pure and honorable a person as I've ever known. And anyway, the funeral was, it was just an absolutely incredible, moving experience. I found out later that someone had actually recorded the whole thing with their cell phone, and they gave me a transcript of it that I actually have. That's been a really invaluable thing.
You lost your wife, Cheryl, your two children, Ian and Julie, in this car accident on Christmas Eve of 2006. And yet after the funeral, you had to put your life back together. How difficult was that to even face? I mean, you're sitting there thinking, my life has been shattered. What do you do?
Oh, there were so many things that were so incredibly hard about that. I remember standing behind the car. At that particular moment, I was looking. It was the only vehicle that we had at the time.
The night of the accident.
Yeah, and I didn't even know how I was going to get home. And so you start to realize the realities of how your life is about to be impacted. My wife and son lay dead. My daughter was being life-flighted away, and ultimately she would pass away as well. And I looked at part of our Christmas strewn around the ground. And I just thought, what on earth am I going to do? At that particular moment, something had happened where I had applied for insurance at my place of employment, and the application didn't get processed because the person went on Christmas vacation. And so I ended up without insurance. And so you're sitting there thinking, I have no car, I have no insurance, I have hundreds of thousands of medical expenses. You think of all those impacts plus the loss of all your loved ones. And you look forward with this utter sense of hopelessness. You just think, how on earth am I ever going to cope?
What got you out of bed the next day and the next day?
Well, first of all, my children. And so, as I mentioned, having to go and visit them and strengthen them, buoy them up. Loved ones poured out of the woodwork from everywhere. We had more than 500 people visit us in the hospital. And it was just an amazing thing. And all of a sudden, we started getting emails and phone calls and letters from all over the country of support. People, of course, things were on the news, and we would get messages that wards were praying and people were fasting and non-members and other churches.
Buoyed up by the goodness of people around you.
Oh, it was amazing to see the outpouring of love and the goodness of people as they then did other things, like in the scriptures, decided to put out a CD, the Serenade CD, and then they also put on a benefit concert. And Hale Center Theater had three performances they did for us where they donated proceeds. And they opened a bank account, and people began donating and things like that. And it was unbelievable. And crime victims reparations and all these other things came to support. But
you know,
I remember.
There's a very important piece of this story that we haven't even talked about yet, and that is the man who hit you. And he was intoxicated that night, and that is an important part. Tell us about when you found out about his high blood alcohol level, when you found out about who he was, when this man all of a sudden had a name and a life of his own. Tell us that piece.
At the scene of the accident, all I knew was that the driver had injured his ankle, but had basically walked away from the accident. I didn't know that he had been a drunk driver until the first time I saw something on the news, actually. And it was really irrelevant to me that he had been drunk. It was irrelevant that he had been an illegal alien.
Even right from the beginning, you didn't have anger boil up because he'd been drinking that night?
No.
Okay.
What first happened was, someone asked me, I believe it was the next day, so probably on Christmas, I was asked by a news reporter, so, you know, you understand that you were hit by a drunk driver. How do you feel about the driver? And I just spoke from my heart, and I said, my heart really goes out to him because he's going to suffer everything that I suffer, every one of those losses, he has to endure. But it's even worse because he knows that he's the cause, which I didn't have to deal with. And, as I thought to myself, people were like, well, he was an illegal alien. He was drunk. I thought, what difference did that make to me? Because if I had been hit by a temple president who was on his way home and had a heart attack, my family would still be gone.
But the fact that this was his third DUI arrest, or the fact that he failed the field sobriety test, it just was a non-issue in your mind.
It really was not an issue at all. I just thought he, in certain ways, I felt was kind of a victim of circumstance. I realize in retrospect how incredibly unlikely it is for two vehicles to be in the same place at the same time. And here it was at a time and place where we had no right being. I mean, we had no reason to have gone home that direction. Normally, Cheryl wouldn't have been driving.
Mm-hmm.
Ian wouldn't have been in the passenger seat. Julie wouldn't have been in the front. Normally, everything would be almost exactly the opposite. And you realize in a split second, if he had been faster, he would have missed us. And when you think of that and you see all of the things that happened leading up to it that made it obvious that the hand of the Lord was in it, then you think, if I'm supposed to give him the blame for doing something that's wrong, should I give him the credit for doing something that was meant to be? And so forgiveness never became an issue for me, because when you think of what we're taught in the scriptures and how clear and powerful it is, you know, we're taught that if we don't forgive, that there remains in us the greater sin.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but when you think of the law of witnesses in DNC 98, it's so clearly stated that basically if someone wrongs you and they don't repent, you forgive them. And if they do it two more times and don't repent, you forgive them. And if they repent, then you forgive them as many times as they repent, until 70 times seven.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
so you sit there today, 3+ years later, and it's never been an issue through all this time. You've never had negative feelings toward this man.
No, in fact, we went down and visited him after the first Christmas. I mean, for the first Christmas after the accident.
And you visited him where?
In Gunnison, in the prison. And he really, really wanted to come and talk to us. We had had such a moving experience at the sentencing, where I stood up and for probably 20 minutes, I pled that they would give him a lighter sentence, because I just thought of how sad it was. I mean, his life had already been impacted.
Shattered also.
And you think, you have to live, you have to wake up every day with the thought that you took three lives. And he wasn't out there trying to kill my family. Mm-hmm. He had had 5 beers, and he made a bad decision at 2:30 in the morning.
You know, I'm thinking about you and your background, and people know a lot about this night and this accident, but one of the things people might not know that I'm thinking has a direct impact on your attitude and the fact that you were able to forgive so freely and so quickly and haven't had those ill feelings toward this man is your previous X amount of years, because you had suffered loss and known loss. These were not your first children that you lost.
That's correct. Yeah, I had actually lost 5 children, 5 of my 9, before the accident.
And tell us about that.
2 more in the accident. It seems like getting children here and trying to keep them here was always an adventure for us. With my first daughter, Clarissa, my wife hemorrhaged when she was about halfway through a pregnancy, and we thought she had actually lost it, and went to an OBGYN, and he was preparing to do a D&C when he decided to do an ultrasound. And when he did, he realized that there was still a heartbeat. And so Cheryl ended up spending the next several months down and gave birth to my daughter, who was healthy. The next pregnancy, my wife was pregnant with twins, a boy and a girl, who we named Jordan and Brianna. And she was, I think about 2-3 months premature when suddenly she went into labor, and those 2 twins were born and died the day that they were born. And that was a really incredibly difficult experience for us because of the fact that it became so unclear. Sometimes, you know, the doctrines, for example, there are times where people will say the spirit enters the body at conception, and others say at quickening, and others say when they take their first breath. And so we were very confused as to whether they had come and gone or if they hadn't come. And the only way we could really cope was that we knew that regardless of what the circumstance was, we knew that they would be ours because mm-hmm. they were born in the covenant.
So you lost those 2 babies to premature, and then more loss.
Then the next child, we found out about halfway through pregnancy that it seemed like he was going to be born with hydrocephalus. Went through this incredible emotional roller coaster trying to find out whether he would actually, whether the hydrocephalus would cause brain damage or not. And we had to wait for the lungs to develop, but the longer you wait, the more damage could be done. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, when he was born, the doctor saw him, said, he looks phenomenal. We're going to just put in a shunt and drain the fluid. And, you know, after all this incredible turmoil, we were just so excited, just elated that he was here and he was healthy. And, excuse me, they came in a few minutes later and said that they had done an MRI or CAT scan in order to find out how they would place the shunt. And they discovered that the reason for the hydrocephalus was not congenital hydrocephalus, but that there was a tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it became the emotional roller coaster.
Of course.
Is it benign? Is it malignant?
And how long did he live?
He had brain surgery the day after he was born. I remember giving him a blessing. And it's so difficult to mention these things because they're so related to other experiences. Like,
sure.
For example, with the blessing that I gave him, when I was on my mission, I had an opportunity on one occasion to give a blessing to a woman who had cancer. And through just absolute marvelous experience and the faith of all the people who were there, who poured out their hearts before the blessing, I was blessed to see this woman healed. And I remember trying to recreate the circumstance in order to bless my son. And my tongue was just stopped. And it was such a powerful experience for me.
You knew.
To realize that, yeah. And anyway, he ended up living for about 3 weeks. We got to have him home. Mm-hmm. And again, part of what helped us in that experience was the fact that it actually goes back to when I was a teenager. It was the first time, as I recall, that I went home teaching. And we went and we visited a young family that had a 2-year-old and a 5-month-old baby. And we were making small talk, I guess, as we first got there. And everyone was talking about how cute the children were and all this mm-hmm. kind of thing. And I was a 14-year-old boy, and so I didn't know anything about children except that I was one. And so I started looking in the equivalent of the topical guide, trying to see if I could find any scriptures that had anything to do with children. And so I would chime in with something. And before you knew it, we had been there like 2.5 or 3 hours and had gone all the way through the topical guide talking about all these scriptures that talk about how children are saved when they die in infancy and how we need to become as little children. And part of what ended up happening is, we left afterwards. My companion, who was the Elders Quorum president, as I recall, actually started screaming at me as we left and saying, you know, who do you think you are? And we just wasted all this time. And I had a message prepared we didn't get to give. We had 4 other people to visit. We didn't get to visit them. And I went home feeling like the worst home teacher in the world. And the next morning I got a phone call. And it was this woman, and she was crying and thanking me. And she all of a sudden said, you don't know what's happened, do you? And I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And she said, last night our 5-month-old baby passed away of SIDS.
And you had just had this 3-hour conversation about children, right. How they're perfect and saved.
And it became such a witness to me that Heavenly Father knew what she was going to experience. And he loved her enough that he could speak through somebody who didn't even know the doctrine himself, you know, that those mm-hmm. things could be mm-hmm. shared. And that testimony was so strong that when I went through the experience myself, I knew what happens to children when they die.
Mm-hmm. And then you lost 2 more children on top of that. So you actually lost 7 of 9 children in your life. I mean,
right.
That is just staggering to think about that. So,
2 more to that same malignant brain tumor.
To the same brain tumor. Mm-hmm.
They said it had happened 54 times in all of recorded medical history, never twice in a family.
And you had 3.
Not amongst cousins, not amongst generations. Mm-hmm. And we had 3.
So you sit across from me today, and as I hear you recount stories that had a big impact on you, as a young home teacher at age 14, as a missionary, as a young father, are you telling me that with your heart, you believe that all of this was supposed to happen?
Absolutely. And I have no doubt that the Lord prepared me from experience to experience for each of the things that was coming. And there were times, for example, when we had already lost 3 children. Then we had Ian, and then we had a daughter named Brianna. And what we did is we decided to name the next boy and the next girl after the twins. And so Jordan had been the son that died of the brain tumor. Mm-hmm. We decided to name the next girl after the other twin, and that was Brianna. we found out when she was 6 months old, she was born with that she had been born with the same tumor. Mm-hmm. She went through a 9-hour brain surgery. And I remember waiting in the waiting room with about a dozen people who were with us, who were fasting and praying. I had people come up to me by the dozens. I had a person come up to me in a grocery store and say, "You don't know who I am, and I'm not a member of your church, but I want you to know that I'm fasting with your steak for your baby." And when she died, I remember thinking of all these people who said, "We watched what happened, and because of what we saw, we've decided to join the church. We've decided to go back to church. We've decided to serve a mission, to stop abusing our children, you know,
all kinds give up of drinking." Outcomes.
Yeah, and I thought, if I live to be 100 years old, I couldn't do 1/1000th the good that my daughter Brianna did in 14 months. And yet, you know, some people would say, well, you know, they expect you to ask why. And so the thing is, most people, when they ask why rhetorically with a clenched fist. And it's why with an exclamation point and not why with a question mark. And so when you really ask why, the Lord tells you why.
Did you ask?
Oh, I certainly did. And it's part of the thing is, you know, it has to do with miracles. You know, with Brianna, we always had a sign up on her picture that said, pray for a miracle or expect a miracle. And we always expected that the miracle that we would receive would be that she would be healed. And yet when you think about it, you think, which is a greater miracle, to heal a baby or for the baby to die and to heal the heart of the mother? And which is a greater miracle, when you see hundreds, if not thousands, of lives impacted because one person or one family suffers? When you see that that can touch thousands of people and help to influence them for good, then you think, what a privilege it is. And when you think of the doctrine, you know, you sit there and you say, what is it you want as a parent? What do you long for as a parent? It's to teach your children in a way so that you can lead them back to the Father. And so here the Lord, in each of those circumstances, the Lord basically guaranteed us that blessing. And so to know, you know, you're going to have them exalted, and you'll even be able to raise them during the millennium when Satan is bound, you know, it's such a marvelous thing. And then you see what happens inside yourself and the changes that happen in you and who you become. You start to realize many of the reasons why.
So beyond seeing this as an adversity that was supposed to happen, you're telling me this adversity, this tragedy, this loss is actually a blessing.
Oh, absolutely. And I just realized I hadn't fully answered your question in the sense that, you know, you were saying, we were talking about it being a preparation, for example. I remember as we would go through it, and then as we lost another son, Braden, mm-hmm. you know, we had basically there was 5 years we tried to have children and couldn't. At one point, my home teacher and I gave a blessing to my wife, and we blessed her that she would have children. It had been 5 years. We didn't think we'd even have one, and yet I promised her we'd have more than one. Julie was born and, of course, was healthy. She died in the accident. Then later we had a son named Braden, and we found out when he was about 3 weeks old that he was born with the same malignant brain tumor. And so, you know, part of it is you start to say, Heavenly Father, you've seen what I will do in this experience, and you know that I will be faithful. You know that I will trust you. And so why do I need to go through it again? Is there something that I haven't done? Is there some way I haven't proven myself?
Or didn't learn the last time?
Yeah. It's sometimes you think it's like people joke about being in a bishopric 4 times mm-hmm. because they haven't ever gotten it right. It's like sooner or later you think, Heavenly Father, please help me get a clue uh-huh. so that I don't have to do this anymore. And so you sit there and you think, why would he do that? And what I realized, but never until later— in retrospect was I thought the Lord had an understanding of what would happen to me, and he had an understanding of what it would be like to lose two children and a wife. I had no idea. And I thought, if I were a kind and loving Heavenly Father, what could I possibly do to prepare somebody for that kind of experience? And what he did is he gave me a taste of that experience over and over and over. And he gave me witness after witness. You know, in 2002, our son Braden died in February. My brother died in June. My mother died in August. I found her dead in her apartment a week after she passed away. But in having to deal with all of those things, with all of those losses, I learned principles, and I learned about death, and I learned about how temporary this life is and how important our trials are in blessing our lives. Not just that we have to endure them, but how they're literally the greatest blessings we experience in our lives are the most difficult times of tribulation and affliction.
And Gary, as we've been speaking this last hour, it's remarkable to me how you've lost seven of your nine children. You've lost your wife. You said you haven't had a problem forgiving the man who was a drunk driver and hit your car that killed three of your family members. And I'm thinking of all the people out in the world who have difficult adversities, really hard things. How do you help them? What would you tell them about not becoming bitter against God?
That is such a huge thing. Part of it, what you realize as you go through those experiences and as you feel that incredible peace that surpasses all understanding, when the Lord comforts you and when you feel encircled about in the arms of love of 10,000 people on each side of the veil, you come to realize how incredibly ridiculous it is to shake your fist at heaven, because all you can say is, you know, why are you trying to make me more like you? And it's the reason why we're here. Mm-hmm. It brings to mind a couple of quotes. Neil A. Maxwell said, "One's life cannot be both faith-filled and stress-free. Therefore, how can you really expect to glide naively through life as if to say, Lord, give me experience, but not grief, not sorrow, not pain, not opposition, not betrayal, and certainly not to be forsaken. Keep from me, Lord, all those experiences which made thee what thou art. Then let me come and dwell with thee and fully share in thy joy." Real faith is required to endure the necessary and painful developmental process that we call life. And the other one is just from President Kimball. He said, why? Why should a righteous mother die and her children be left motherless? Could the Lord have prevented this tragedy? The answer is yes. The Lord is omnipotent, with all power to control our lives, to save us pain, prevent all accidents, drive all cars, feed us, protect us, save us from labor, effort, sickness, even from death. But is that what you would want? Would you shield your children from effort, from disappointments, temptations, sorrow, suffering? The basic gospel law is free agency. To force us to be careful or righteous would be to nullify that fundamental law, and growth would be impossible. Should we be protected always from hardship, pain, suffering, sacrifice, or labor? Should the Lord protect the righteous? Should he immediately punish the wicked? If growth comes from fun and ease and aimless irresponsibility, then why should we ever exert ourselves to work or learn or overcome? If success is measured by the years we live, then early death is failure and tragedy. If earth life is the ultimate, how can we justify death even in old age? If we look at mortality as a complete existence, then pain, sorrow, failure, and short life can be a calamity. But if we look upon life as an eternal thing, stretching far into the pre-earth past and on into the eternal post and future, then all happenings may be put in their proper perspective. Is there not wisdom in God's giving us trials that we may rise above them, responsibilities that we might achieve, work to harden our muscles, sorrow to try our souls? Are we not permitted temptations to test our strength, sickness that we might learn patience, and death that we might be immortalized and glorified? If mortality be the perfect state, then death would be a frustration. But the gospel teaches us that there is no tragedy in death, only in sin.
It's obvious to me that those quotes have had a huge impact on you.
My. It's just, it becomes so evident. There's one says that the sweetest, happiest, tenderest homes are not those where there's been no sorrow, but those that have been overshadowed with grief and where Christ's comfort was accepted. It mentions that the very memory of the sorrow is like a gentle benediction that broods over the household like the silence that comes after prayer. There's a blessing from God set in every sorrow. And the thing is, people don't understand that. You know, they can understand the sorrow. They understand the grief and the pain.
The loss.
You know, because you lose seven people and all this. And you think, how on earth do you endure that? But what they don't understand is the peace. What they don't understand is the comfort and the fact that it's only if you know the mighty grief that you can know the mighty rapture. And every bit of sorrow stretches out places in the soul for joy. And so you come to have a depth of feeling that's so incredible in everything. It's not just that you know sadness that other people may not know or the same type or whatever, but you come to feel gratitude. Like the next time a healthy baby is placed on your wife's stomach after having lost four in a row or whatever, you know, you all of a sudden you say, there's no way to express how that's multiplied a hundredfold.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. It seems to me as you're telling your own story, Gary, that each of the experiences you had, whether it's, you know, through your own childhood or early adulthood, whatever, seemed to prepare you for the next. And it seemed to be a growth process, or you haven't had to be beset with bitterness. But what do you tell someone who doesn't feel that immense peace that you got because you had been on this process, on this pathway, journey for such a long time? What about someone that has this, that experiences this kind of loss, but doesn't feel it? How do they find that peace?
Oh, that's marvelous. You know, I deal with that almost on a daily basis. Because you come across people who are suffering in so many different ways. They're dealing with divorce. They're dealing with wayward children, with spouses who have violated their covenants. They deal with their victims of abuse, or they're homeless, or
all of the above and more. And they're sitting here listening to you saying, yeah, I would love to feel no bitterness, or I would love to never feel like shaking my fist at heaven. Help them, because you've been through such loss. What do you tell them about looking for and ultimately finding peace that sets you free from bitterness?
One of the most difficult things to learn and the most extraordinary things to experience is when you finally come to the realization that, and it should be very self-evident, but God is actually smarter than me and He loves me. It's like there's a difference between faith and hope in my mind. For example, faith is saying, I know that God lives. I know that He answers prayers. He loves His children. It's different. Hope is saying, I know that God loves me. I know that God answers my prayers. And I know that He has a hand in my personal life. And so part of it is coming to a point where you can surrender your will to His. For me, that happened in the back of an ambulance as I was sitting there. I was praying. I had just finished talking to my brother, telling him what had happened. And we were on our way to the hospital. I knew they had life-flighted Juliana away. And suddenly my heart totally changed.
And you remember the moment.
And I remember the moment. And I said to myself, I said to the Lord, I said, these children were yours before they were mine. And who am I to counsel God on when it's right for someone to come or someone to go? We don't come together. We don't have to go together. And so who am I to say that it's their time or it's not? And so what I did is, for the first time, always I was pleading with the Lord with each child. I was saying, please let them live. Nevertheless, you know, if it's thy will, then you can have them. In this case, for the first time, I surrendered my heart to the Lord, and I said, Lord, I trust you, and Julie is yours. You do with her whatever seemeth you good. And in that moment, I felt a total change in me.
So what you're saying then to other people to answer my question is a change has to come within your own heart where you surrender to the will of the Lord.
Absolutely.
And is that the first step?
Part of it is just trusting in the Lord.
Just trusting.
Just knowing that He loves you and that every problem will ultimately end.
So the trust will really come first and then you surrender.
Yeah. You think of what's the worst that could possibly happen, and no matter how bad it is, it always has some kind of a positive outcome, you know. And
if you choose to see it that way.
Right. I mean, because ultimately every type of suffering will end. But I just spoke with someone recently who was having tremendous financial difficulties. And we went through, after the loss of those five children and before the accident, you know, the Christmas prior, mm-hmm. we had gone from the point where we were looking at a very solid six-figure income as CEO of a company and owning multiple businesses and things. We went to the point where that Christmas prior to that, people were leaving things on our doorstep and we were getting help from the bishop. And here a year later, that's part of what made us so incredibly grateful. That was the hardest thing I ever went through. When people go through the loss of a child, or when everything splattered all over the news and hundreds of thousands of people are praying for you, it's easy to be carried through something. When you see the person who's next to you in church who is jobless, or who's having trouble in their marriage or with the wayward son, and nobody has any idea, nobody's praying for them. It's just like with Carlos. I said,
Carlos being the man who—
Carlos Prieto, the
right,
man who hit
us. The driver of the car that hit your car.
Yeah. When they asked how I felt about him, I said, my heart goes out to him because I have hundreds of thousands of people praying for me. But who's praying for him?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Carlos just for a second. You've actually continued to have interaction post-sentencing. You said the sentencing itself was a spiritual experience.
It was an extraordinary experience.
Just quickly explain that, and then tell me about your subsequent interaction with Carlos Prieto.
Well, basically at the sentencing, we were asked to go and to give our opinion, to state what our opinion was of what we would like to see happen in the sentencing. And so my attorney didn't have any idea what kind of a message I had prepared, but I prepared something that lasted about 15 or 20 minutes. And I made a statement where—
And Carlos is present.
Carlos was present. Mm-hmm. When he walked in the room, he looked over at me, and I remember smiling at him. And it's even extraordinary to me as I think back on that. But he saw me smile, and he sort of half-smiled and then felt really embarrassed and couldn't look up anymore. And anyway, I stood up and I, for about 15 or 20 minutes, I pled with the judge to be lenient because I said, Carlos made a bad decision at 2 a.m. Who has not done that? You know, Carlos had 5 beers. His fiance had just broken up with him and he was driving around aimlessly because he was despondent. That's the reason why he had the beers, was because he was despondent. He was looking for comfort and peace because his life had just been shattered. He wasn't out there trying to do something horrible. And so I said, why should he be punished more? I mean, if three funerals doesn't convince him not to drink and drive, then 3 consecutive terms of 5 years isn't going to teach him a thing more. And if it has changed him, then what's the benefit of making it so his 2-year-old is 17 before he sees them again?
Paint a picture for us of that courtroom, because your 15-minute speech plea to the judge had a huge impact on everybody in that courtroom, even the bailiffs.
The bailiffs, absolutely. One of them is in my stake, actually, and shared some of his feelings that he had. I remember looking around and as we talked about things, I spoke about things from the Book of Mormon and Doctrine and Covenants. I said, you know, of you it is required to forgive all men. You know, I, the Lord, will forgive whom I will forgive. And if we don't, we stand condemned. And so it's like forgiveness is a total non-issue. And I said, we have forgiven him. And so all that I require, what I told the judge is, I said, for us personally as a family, all that we really require is that he shake our hand and look us in the eye and say, I will never do this again. And I really believe that that kind of experience would change a person sufficiently that they could do that. Now, I understand that there are other criteria, and that the law demands something else, and that the law has to make a statement about drinking and driving and things of that nature. And so I acquiesced, and I just said, I understand those things, and I acquiesce to those judges, both in the court here and in the court above, who need to do something more. But as for us, I asked for a lighter sentence for him because I thought there'd been enough suffering already. And Carlos was crying. His translator was crying. I spoke in Spanish part of the time for his sake and called him hermano, my brother. He is my brother. And the bailiffs were wiping away tears. The media were wiping away tears. My family, his family. All of us understood that we're victims of circumstance. And none of us wanted to be in that position. But how can you not feel compassion for a man who's now facing a decade and a half away from his family? So all of them are going to suffer now. He has to suffer my family's loss. He has to suffer the guilt of my family's loss. Then he has to suffer his family's loss. And they are pained. And it's just like everybody mm-hmm. suffers more. And so I just said, why?
So he was sentenced and he did go to prison. But that is not where your relationship with Carlos ended. Tell us about that.
No. And incidentally, what was so extraordinary is I asked for the sentence to be lightened. Then Carlos was given an opportunity to speak, and he said, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate the love and forgiveness that this family has offered. But he said, I can't accept it because I don't deserve it. And then he asked for a stiffer sentence. If people had understood that, you know, you hear this outcry of this illegal alien and all these people who are so vehement about drunk driving and things, which obviously I feel passionately about as well. But anyway, to see that was such an extraordinary thing. And in the end, we were hugging his family and would have hugged him, quite frankly, if we had the chance. But he was in shackles and was taken mm-hmm. away.
And what was his sentence?
They did lighten the sentence to from 15 years to 10. Mm-hmm. And they also made it so that, as I requested, they ran them concurrently, I guess, instead of
consecutively.
Mm-hmm. And so anyway, in 10 years, he would be free. But at that point, I guess he's going to be deported. And so we went and visited him the following Christmas down in Gunnison at the prison.
Who's we?
It was actually my new family mm-hmm. and I. And my daughter was not able to go at the time. And as I recall, I don't believe that Caleb was able to either. Just emotionally, it was just too hard.
Still.
And it was actually helpful because for him, I asked if he wanted to see a picture of my family, and he said he couldn't. And anyway, when he came, he was a totally different person than the one that people see on the news, the, you know, glassy-eyed mm-hmm. foreign person, you know. Instead, he came and he was wearing glasses. He was clean-shaven. He was very bright-eyed. He'd been studying English, so I tried speaking to him in Spanish, and much of the time he wanted to speak in English. He'd been getting an education, and he shared what had happened to him that evening, and he apologized over and over. And he said, this was another thing, he said at the sentencing and repeated in the prison, he said, I would gladly give my life if it would return this man's family or his happiness. And I'm supposed to hate this man? There's just no way.
Gary Saran, giving us a firsthand tutorial on forgiveness. Thank you so much. It's really quite an amazing life that you've been leading.
It's been an extraordinary experience when you understand how the Lord shapes you and molds you through those experiences and teaches you a depth of joy that you couldn't know without them. It's phenomenal.
Before the break, we talked about death, and you have said to us during this interview and during the breaks that you have come to understand some interesting things about death. I think a lot of people are afraid of the unknown, and even though they might have faith in life after death and a certain understanding, it's still that fear of unknown. Teach us what you know about death.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm so grateful for is a book by Richard Iyer and Paul H. Dunn called The Birth We Call Death. There are many things that I learned from that and have often referred to it because I've had so many opportunities to refer to it where I needed comfort in going through those experiences. Some things I remember from them there's a story I shared at the funerals for the three of them. It says, in a beautiful blue lagoon on a clear day, a fine sailing ship spreads its brilliant white canvas in a fresh morning breeze and sails out to the open sea. We watch her glide away magnificently through the deep blue and gradually see her grow smaller and smaller as she nears the horizon. Finally, where the sea and sky meet, she slips gently from sight, and someone near me says, there, she's gone. Gone? Gone where? Gone from sight, that's all. She is still as large in mast and hull and sail, still just as able to bear her load, and we can be sure that just as we say, there, she is gone, another on an even more distant, more beautiful distant shore says, there, she comes. Death is like a train ride with a stranger. One man loses his billfold containing a large sum of money. Another with the same amount sets goals and makes a planned investment. Both are now separated from their money, but one feels the bite and bitterness of permanent loss, while the other anticipates the day when he will retrieve his investment and enjoys the knowledge that it will probably grow in the meantime. And so part of understanding the separation, when you understand how it's not permanent, but that life is, it helps you to appreciate that. And there are so many things that have been said. Ben Franklin's epitaph is one that is probably oft quoted, where he says, like the cover of an old book, its contents torn out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here food for worms. But the work shall not be lost, for it will, as he believes, appear once more in a new and more elegant edition, revised and corrected by the author. There are just so many things that all teach the same basic principle that each of us was born, in essence, to die. And each of us is going to have that time when we're called back to return to our Father in heaven. And there is no tragedy in it. I had a brother who spent 15 years out of the church right before he died. And when he died, there was tragedy in sin. I felt so much more pain at his death than I had in all of the others combined because I had such a concern and a question about what would happen with him. And ultimately, in fact, a year or two later, I was able to have his blessings restored by the First Presidency. It was an amazing thing. Even then, there's always hope.
And there is no bitterness in you. And to look at your face, you have a very peaceful-looking face. I know that people at home can't see that. But as I've watched you, there is just kindness and softness around your eyes and in your voice. They probably can hear that. In the meantime, though, it must be terribly lonely. And you must feel the loss. You must miss them. Yes, you know you'll see them again. But you must miss these children and your wife terribly.
You know, the time right afterwards was extremely difficult. I remember coming home, I guess it was several days after Christmas when we were finally all released from the hospital. I walked in the house to the Christmas tree that we had decorated as a family, to the presents that had names of people who no longer were there. I saw the star on our little Advent calendar that had never been put up. And as I walked through the house, I went to the refrigerator and I saw a magnet with a picture of Clarissa and Juliana when they had just gone to Disney on Ice. I saw my wife's nightgown thrown over a chair and things of that nature. Everything set me off and I was just crying incessantly, it seemed. And yet there was such a peace and such a comfort where I really honestly felt for almost 2 months as if they were close to me. And I remember, in fact, the moment when I felt as if they left. I was listening to the Tabernacle Choir, and there's a very beautiful song that it talks about. It's called "May the Good Lord Bless and Keep You." You know, till we meet again.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost felt as if it was Cheryl just singing it to me as I was actually taking down the Christmas tree. I kept it up until about the end of February and was finally taking it down. And in that moment, it was one of those Gethsemane moments. There are times where, you know, you read things like the poem Footprints.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about that one set of footprints, and those are the times when the Lord's carrying you. And reality is that there are times in your life when that one set of footprints is going to be yours, and there's nobody there carrying you, and you are going to go through your own personal Gethsemane. And Joseph Smith experienced it, and he cried out, "Oh God, where art thou?" And the Son of God himself experienced it when he cried out on the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And he was left alone because he had to do it alone. And there are times where we have to do it alone. But for me, the tremendous blessing is how short that time was that I was alone. And I was just thinking how I just recently celebrated my second anniversary, how in March of 2008, I was privileged to get married again. And what an absolute miracle that has been, to have been twice blessed in marriage with two of the most extraordinary saintly women. Our marriages, in both cases, they've been blessed by some governing principles. You know, we decided we don't want to raise our voice unless the house is on fire. We decided you are going to focus 100% on my needs and I'm going to focus 100% on yours, so that we live in total selflessness and yet our needs are met. And in doing that, here I have a beautiful new wife. I have four new children and my wife has 10 brothers and sisters. And so I look at my life and here I was sitting behind my car or standing mm-hmm. behind my car thinking I have no insurance. My savings had just been spent as I was going through, you know, having nearly lost my business, selling two houses the same day, all these other things. And in the midst of all this turmoil, I'm looking forward and thinking utter hopelessness. We had been renting a townhome because we had had to sell our homes to avoid.
I'm thinking, what is my life going to be? It's in shambles today.
Yeah. And here now I'm looking back, you know, 3 years later, and I think now I own my home free and clear mm-hmm. and I have no debt and I have savings and I have this extraordinary new family. And I sit there and I marvel over how it's possible. And I recognize that none of it is my own doing. It's by the grace of God, it's by his goodness and his mercy that blessings have just been poured out on me in that way.
Well, you were telling me you just cannot know what is around the next corner of your life. And that's the nature of life. That's how it's supposed to be.
And we were just in the temple the other day and we were sitting there in the celestial room saying, who would have ever guessed? I mean, here we actually met on LDSSingles.com, which is as ironic as it gets, you know, because we never would have met in a million years otherwise. And to think that we were there experiencing what we were with now our children and our family.
Mm-hmm.
It's so beautiful, and I am so incredibly grateful.
You seem very happy in your new marriage, and yet there are constant reminders that I think are interesting ties to life before the accident. You have your wife's voice on your son's cell phone. Is that right?
It's really strange. Sometimes I'll call him, and if he doesn't answer his phone, my first wife, Cheryl, will answer the phone and
never
say—
Never changed it.
Yeah. And she'll say, leave a message and I'll get back with you as soon as I can. And it really helps to keep things in perspective because you realize the fact of the matter is she will do that mm-hmm. as soon as she can. And she's not really very far away.
And you get to hear Ian's voice because of a wonderful experience he had. Tell us that.
Yeah, Ian and Clarissa had the opportunity of reading the ensign for the blind. And so they would be recorded, and then those recordings would go out to help the blind. One of them is a story about a tragedy where there's the loss of mm-hmm. of some loved ones, and he bears basically on behalf of the author, he's bearing testimony that life is eternal and that families are forever, and that he knows those things. And so to hear him say those words was so incredibly poignant and powerful. And the CD was given to us just after he died, so that actually at his funeral, he was able to speak, in essence, at his own funeral.
Because you played a clip.
Yes, we played a clip of it, and it was very, very moving.
You know, I'd love to share with our audience here a clip of Ian reading from that Ensign article, which was also heard at his funeral. So we're going to take a quick break and listen to Ian Saran speaking at his own funeral.
I know that families can be forever. On a day like today, 15 years ago, my family and I were sealed as an eternal family in the Lima, Peru temple, and this is what comforts me. My family and I continue to experience many difficulties, but each time my testimony falters, I remember the time when the Holy Ghost comforted me and testified to me of the eternal truths of the gospel. Read by Ian Saran.
That was Ian Saran on a recording that he taped for the Ensign magazine and then that was later played at his funeral. That must have been an amazing moment for all of those people in that church that day.
Yes, it was. It was that funeral was one of the most spiritual experiences of my life. It was just an absolutely extraordinary time. And the prophet stood up just afterwards and actually left an apostolic blessing on mm-hmm. on the congregation. And many lives were changed that day.
And you're continuing to change lives. In fact, you're putting your experiences and all of the things you've learned into a book. You're having a hard time, I understand, keeping it under 500 pages. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I don't know how to do it. My biggest dilemma, quite frankly, is that the things that bring me the most comfort and have helped me through these experiences are mostly things that are very specific to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And as you try to help people beyond the church and to try to be an influence for good in other people's lives, it becomes very difficult to know how you can share those things in a way that they'll be palatable to them and they'll accept them.
Well, in a way they can help them regardless of their experience, religion, background. You still want to help them with the same ideas.
Right.
Does it have a working title and when will it be out?
Well, at the moment, I'm just thinking of calling it Blessed by Adversity since I finally had the last chapter. What I've realized is that the Lord has other ideas and those chapters have kept coming. And so, I really don't know. I would like to have it out by Thanksgiving of this year.
Well, we'll keep our eyes open for it. I want to go back to the very beginning. This accident happened on Christmas Eve, and you and your family were in community theater at Hale Center Theater doing a Christmas carol, and you were playing the role of Bob Cratchit. And you say that you really relate to Bob Cratchit, and now we know why. Explain a little further.
Well, for one, I worked in finance in the church office building for about 17 years, and I used to always joke with people about, you know, how it was so difficult to try to be a left-brain, linear, mm-hmm. sequential,
mm-hmm.
Green visor and armband kind of person, because I was kind of a right-brain guy living in a left-brain world. But beyond that, there's a scene in the play where the ghost of Christmas future is showing Scrooge what life will be like if he doesn't change. And part of what they're looking at is when Tiny Tim has passed away. And so Bob Cratchit and his wife at one point end up standing at the grave of the child. And so each time I performed that, before I went on stage, I used to either look at pictures or just remember different children who we buried. And, you know, when you think of these tiny little caskets, that's a very moving thing. And so the scene was always very moving. After the accident, one thing that changed is in the scene just prior, I actually find Tiny Tim's crutch on the mantle and stare at it. And what I would always do as I picked up that crutch is I would picture the sword that my son Ian was buried with. And I would remember. It's one of the most important words in the English language, is remember. And those are things you never want to forget. In fact, there are times where I've said I miss the pain, and where you need to remember that, because it tutors you and teaches you to feel. And so each night we would perform that. I would think of my sons, and I would think of those who I'd lost at the grave. And it was very easy to be to make it
character
moving and make it
important. Well, there's
important.
You know, some degree of irony, but it's no surprise at all how you can relate to one of these memorable characters created by Charles Dickens. You have a poem that you brought that you would like to share that you say sums up your feelings in large part. Go ahead.
Yes, this is something that I wrote for the funeral of my wife, Cheryl, my son, Ian, and my daughter, Juliana. Of all the wonders, it's called The Greatest Wonder. Of all the wonders in this world, the greatest of all I knew sought I, for in my arms my boy, my girl, and soulmate were about to die. In stunning stillness, steeped in death, my spirit troubled and confused, I prayed for strength and living breath for them and us. These words I used. Upon my knees, yea, face to dust, I seek thy comfort found above, and plead for peace. O Lord, I must be strengthened by thy boundless love. Thou knowest how my soul is aching, who more than thee this pain could know. Dear God, my quivering heart is breaking, please bless me this one thing to know. Thou sayest that through administrations we may draw on godly powers, if death be not one's ordination, and if sufficient faith is ours. Oh, is my faith sufficient, Lord, that these deep yearnings of my soul can bring thy finger or thy word to bless and heal and make us whole? Yea, us, for are we not all ailing, fleeing death yet ever near it? Every life is frail and failing, some in body, some in spirit. While some seek health, some make confession, but all petition greater strength, for we all require thy intercession if we're to be made whole at length. O Lord, who made both earth and skies, thou God, omnipotent, omniscient, my King, most merciful and wise, I beg thee, make my faith sufficient. I believe, but help thou mine unbelief, and I shall walk upon the waters. But if, as Peter, I seek relief, Lord, save my wife and sons and daughters. Behold, these lives lain on the altar. As Isaac's life, Lord, theirs we give. We offer all, though our hearts falter.
pleading, "Stay thy hand and let them live." Oh, must we drink this bitter cup that we might comprehend thy Son? If so, behold, we drink it up. Thy will, O Lord, not ours be done. Then came his voice. I still can hear it. Making known his mind, his will, his love, his peace, his very spirit. Yea, I knew God as I was still. And there on my knees, I felt his power. And oh, what wondrous things I learned. For he was with me that very hour. And upon my heart these words he burned. Though lame should walk, or blind should see, or dead men rise and be made whole, the greatest wonder of all, said he, is the salvation of the human soul. Though all God's wonders doth astound me, the greatest yet we scarce could tell, for miracles were all around me, some wrought in my own soul as well. Our loved ones died, but live once more, for Christ hath saved us from the fall, and we've the peace we pleaded for. Our Savior's love engulfs us all. Now I see in this refining moment his purpose, yea, the reason why. And I know, through his divine atonement, they've all been saved, and so was I.
Thank you. Quickly before we leave, Caleb and Clarissa, how are they doing?
They're doing amazingly well.
Health-wise, any repercussions?
No. They basically, for several days, Clarissa was unable to walk. We were very concerned, obviously, since she wanted to be a dancer. Mm-hmm. For those who saw us perform Christmas Carol this past year, Clarissa was there dancing right alongside us. Caleb, who had broken ribs and pelvis and so forth, has completely recovered. My daughter Clarissa is married now. She got married about a month after I did, which was really strange. They actually went on their honeymoon to one of the same places where we stopped about 3 weeks after we were there.
But they're doing well. Babies. They're fine, and they're happy and leading good lives.
They are. They're doing absolutely marvelously. My son Caleb is an extraordinary individual. He now does portraits and writes music, and he was given a blessing. He was actually born 3 weeks after my daughter Brianna died, and was when I gave him a name and a blessing. The blessing mentioned that he would be a joy and a comfort to his parents, and he was one of those who really carried me through the experience. And the Lord has blessed me tremendously with the children who remained with me. His hand is so evident in that those who could survive without the others did, and they have been a joy and a comfort to me, as have my wife and my four new children.
Gary Saran, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been
listening to Conversations on the Mormon Channel. We hope you'll join us again for another edition of Conversations.
This has been Conversations, a program featuring discussions with members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with a unique perspective or an interesting story. Today's conversation has been with Gary Saran. Ruth Todd was the host. This program is available for downloading as a podcast, or you can listen to it on demand on the Mormon Channel. If you have feedback or comments on this or other programs on the Mormon Channel, or a thought you want to share that may be used on the station, call 1-888-MY-LDS-321. That's 1-888-MY-LDS-321. You can also contact us by visiting the website at radio.lds.org. Thank you for listening to the Mormon Channel. Tell your friends about us.